Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
So tell me, how are you, Rob?
I'm feeling political today.
Okay, well, that's a good feeling. I think we're all feeling political at the minute, but why are you feeling political especially?
Well, I think I've realised that, as we all know, the world is currently in a big time of important and much needed change and reassessment about society. Mm-hmm. And in particular, the Black Lives Matter movement, which is at the centre of my attention. And I've been spending the last few weeks reading, learning as much as
educating.
I possibly can, watching every documentary, some nights not being able to sleep because I'm so kind of infuriated by the kind of injustice and the systemic kind of... Yeah, it's just kind of overwhelming in a way.
Yep.
But at the same time, I'm grateful that so many people we know are waking up. And I feel like there is going to be a long sort of time now where people are going to start to change their businesses, change the way things are set up. Mm. And the guest we have today, she was born in 1988 and at a time of incredible change in Mozambique, where she grew up. And the civil war there ended in 1992. So she herself has come through childhood through this kind of political turbulence and change. Mm. And trauma, and I'm really looking forward to talking to her about her incredible painting, but also her performance art and her love of music and film and storytelling, things that we hold dear to our hearts. And I've been incredibly touched by her work, and I've actually discovered it thanks to Russell Tovey.
Rob, I bring you all the magic.
You do, actually. You have been doing that recently a lot, and I'm super grateful for that. So thanks. We would like to welcome to Talk Art, Cassie Namoda.
Hi, Cassie.
Hello.
you didn't know when to come in then. Hi, how are you?
Yeah, no, I mean, I was just kind of struck by that wonderful introduction. So I was sort of in a rumination almost. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Of course. Where do we find you, Cassie? Where in the world are you?
I'm currently in my studio. You caught me kind of puttering about, and I'm just sort of painting my walls. I just recently moved into the studio. It's in East Hampton, New York, where I live and work. My studio is sort of 2 minutes from my house, so I'm very grateful for that. You know, during the pandemic, I was able to keep a practice, which I don't know what I would have done if I did not have a practice showing up to a studio. But you know what? Actually, I do know what I would have done. I probably would have just like watched a lot of movies and read a lot, which actually sounds equally good. But there's this thing I get. It's like this sort of like anxiety or something when I'm not using my hands to make something. And I guess also like what you said earlier, the kind of political instability in this country and just everything that's just been happening in the world in the past, you know, few months, it feels like I'm kind of like just trying to stay above the waves in a way.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
And you can do that through painting. Do you feel like it's a therapeutic way of channeling anxieties in the world right now into your work?
You know, honestly, Yes, you know, but it depends. Like, I think there's two things that artists sort of deal with when they are working in sort of the commercial art market. It's like, it's so important, and I have to kind of keep this true to myself in the sense that it's like, it can be overwhelming working in the agency of the art market. And I feel like previous to, you know, entering an exhibition, it was like my practice was really much like a work on paper, and I would take it anywhere in the world. I had no kind of fixed studio. This is sort of the first real fixed studio I have. Mm-hmm. And I would just paint anywhere, and it was so immediate and it was so free. And it's weird. I'm kind of longing for those days because of something about like, you know, yeah, I think that the art, it's important for art to be free in the sense of that the artist has agency over their work and there's no pressure. And I think that, you know, that's something that I try to, you know, just because the gallery says they need to work in 2 weeks, I might have to decline, you know, in a way, because I need time, you know. Oh, I need time, and I need to sit with the work, and I need to ruminate. And maybe sometimes you just want to show up to your studio and stare out the window, you know, and not really think about anything else. So I just think that the free will is the sort of moving point in a practice.
I felt happy for a lot of artists that they could capitalize on this experience, especially artists like yourself, where there is a lot of attention on you right now, that you can take this slowing down period when there isn't as much pressure to make work for the art market and use it to just, as you're saying, ruminate and live in that. But actually, the art market, the art world hasn't actually slowed down throughout this pandemic. It feels like
it's like on steroids.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? Like, and I think like a lot of people just like, you know, we need culture to survive. We need art to survive, to keep identity, to keep some sort of inspiration or kind of transcend a moment. And I think that's when artists have to kind of pull up their bootstraps and sort of rise to the occasion.
Yeah.
So it's almost like when I show up to the studio now, I feel a sort of, not burden, I feel a responsibility in a way. And like, yeah,
to yourself,
I mean, I've
to
maybe
your own
felt,
practice or to the galleries or to the art market or?
Not the art market. It's to make sure that this crucial, important time in the world that I am able to give someone or a group of people or a mass appeal, something to look to in terms of a relief. This is humanity. Humanity is always tearing between pain and joy, suffering and happiness. We live in duality. So I think that this is sort of where my work stems from. So when I made the show for Nina Johnson,
that's currently was up now, of, isn't it? It's like an online show.
Correct.
In Miami.
Yeah, an online show, small scale. Yeah, Miami online, small scale paintings. And I made that show, like, you know, I was in Lamu, Kenya at a residency, and I was sort of busy thinking about my show. And I was there sort of creating the kind of conceptual idea around my show opening with Goodman Gallery in the autumn. And, you know, the world quickly changed at that moment within, like, a few weeks. I was in Johannesburg, and then I took, you know, the next flight out because it was talk of the airport shutting down. And honestly, to be honest, I don't know if I would have been that mad being stuck in Africa because, like, New York was quite manic. It was not a pretty sight here. So, but, you know, so then I found that, like, okay, like I realized that there's something that was so urgent in the moment and that the future was neither here nor there, because like where how we kind of function in the West is that the future is kind of this like end goal that we're always striving towards, and we're constantly thinking about the future, and when I'm making work I'm thinking about the future, and that puts this sort of weird kind of almost capital behind living. And when I realized that my show in South Africa might be subject to change, or maybe, you know, and that was the reality to maybe towards next year or whatever, I had taken Nina back up on this idea of making small paintings set aside from the currency of, you know, the art market or whatever. It was really just about the sort of almost intuitive sort of cathartic release that I wanted to put on small paintings, and then also kind of like humor and sort of like this idea that we don't need to know everything, or we don't have to know, we don't have to have an answer, or we don't have to contextualize everything we come across. So that's why I called it dog meat, cat meat, God knows what meat, you know. And then you see the painting of like a red squirrel that's endemic to Mozambique, where my family is from up north, and you might see a girl on crutches with balloons in the background. So I felt that show was important, kind of, I don't know, like spiritual work for right now. And I had told everyone, like, maybe, like, instead of calling this lockdown or putting this sort of manic fear, like, you know, also this society tends to function on fear. So it's like, stocks are going down, like, take all your money out of the stocks. It's like people are just really like functioning on that fear base. And it was just like, you know, we can live in uncertain times and also be able to like digest everything we feel if we're just present in the moment. And so that was kind of what the show was sort of about. It's like, and I had urged people maybe to consider this a spiritual vacation in a way, rather than quote unquote lockdown, because they want you to call it lockdown and this sort of thing. So I just felt like I just wanted to come from a different point of view that I felt was sort of true to me.
And I really feel like with your work as well, you know, when you mentioned earlier this idea of like two sides and kind of like double
duality
within your work, I feel like your particular perspective as an artist, I feel like you do always sort of seek out these other meanings and hidden meanings that we perhaps living everyday life might not have time to observe. And what I find so fascinating about the whole Black Lives Matters movement is that I think that introspective time everyone's actually had during lockdown is exactly what you're describing. It's been some kind of like almost like introspective, spiritual, you know, even having to confront the self. And I think people have time to actually consider, you know, what it feels like to be someone else in a different situation, or you know, which is often actually the job of an artist.
Yeah, well, I'm going to jump in as well, because I agree with you, but I also think it's a time that people recognize, because this pandemic has affected everyone on the planet, that we are all exactly the same, and everyone is going through the same struggle and the same fear and the same anxiety, and everyone wants to live, everyone wants to cure, everyone wants the insulin that will stop you getting it. So it's suddenly like you have a connection with everyone else on the planet, which means even more so when stuff's coming up that, like, when there is issues like this, it makes you even more determined suddenly, because you're recognizing yourself in these scenarios now.
I think there's a couple of points mentioned, and I'll start off with the first about symbolism in my work, because, you know, that's something that I can speak quite, you know, intuitive on.
Yeah.
For me, I feel that when I'm making work, or even living life, or even my cultural background and the work and research that I do, is that everything that is surrounding us is some sort of symbolism if we adhere to it, if we're sensitive to it. And a lot of the work and research that I do is thinking about spiritualism in our everyday life, and in especially in a kind of what stems from my work is definitely from my upbringing in Africa, you know, and I think a lot about East African society. And, you know, those writings by John Mbiti, where he's a African Christian theologian, and he talks about sort of kind of philosophies around living, and like sort of like, you know, a rock can be a symbolism of a sort of godly thing or object, you know. So like in my work, I might put like a red chair as sort of, for me, as a religious object. So this idea of like sitting with self and sort of thinking and in your deep kind of consciousness. So I do tear to symbolism in work, whether it's always apparent or not, but like a, you know, girl on crutches with a smile and an eye patch with balloons in the background, there's symbolisms in that. It's this idea that, you know, pain can, to experience pain, you also have to experience happiness, and vice versa. Like, mm-hmm. we need all these feelings in living. That's living, you know? And then not taking it from where my inspiration draws from or my lineage, I'll take it to where we are today in a kind of global sense, and also in the United States of America. And also, this is also a mass movement. It's a global movement that's happening in Brazil. It's happening in Sweden. You know, anywhere there's socioeconomic issues and injustice, I think it is being addressed now, because what had happened through the pandemic, it was very obvious in some countries, and especially in the United States, that there was definitely high tiers of people living very different lives. And I think even those who are not in like the upper middle class, and maybe they're just middle class, they were able to get out of the big cities, get out of New York City, mm-hmm. you know, and go upstate and get their, like, you know, $2,000 a month, like, little cottage, but, you know, away from... And then you had Black families stuck in the, you know, tiny apartments in a kind of co-op building, and some of them might still have to go to work, and they didn't have any choice. And then there was, like, food insecurities that were very obvious to, you know, a certain group of people. And I think that... And I felt like anyone with any sort of compassion, doesn't matter what race, is very sensitive to what was going on. They're like, oh, wait, these people didn't get to escape. Black people didn't get to leave the city, or, you know, anyone in a socioeconomic, like, sort of, like, injustice, like, where they are, you know, experiencing systematic racism. You know, they were at the most vulnerable point in this country during a time that no one really had answers for, and we still don't have complete answers to the virus. And, you know, we're just moving on because, you know, that's what's been said to do. But so I think that a lot of people felt guilty about that. They felt angry about that. They felt saddened by that. And then you had now... You know, people had seen the video, you know, of George Floyd. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something so visceral about that video, because I think in this country, guns have been normalized, you know, because it's been such a, you know, a spoken about thing, a weapon of oppression. It's been used in schools. It's been used, you know, in every... way. And I think that there's something about that video without the guns yes. in there, but yes. that it made people like, wow, that's like a cold-blooded killer. None of it's different, whether it's a gun or a knee on the neck, it's not different, but there's something about that layered, it was like a cumulative thing. It was like almost like a volcanic eruption, because it was like that video, you know, and a couple of weeks before Breonna in, you know, Taylor in her bed sleeping at night, and like people are just like, what is going on, you know? And it's, I think that is why this is all coming to this point. It's a boiling point, it's a tipping point, you know. And I think that really the work right now, it's like if you had seen yourself at any point, it's a reflection period, you know. I think it's a reflection period for people to think about what they want from this country, you know, how they want to better themselves, if they are people of privilege, you know, and how they can change within their work environment, within their everyday life. So I think that there's something sort of really magical going on. And it's destructive. It's a cathartic release. It's cathartic. It's totally cathartic, you know. And I think this purge needs to happen. Mm-hmm. And I'm positive on the other side, there will be some change. I don't know how fast it's going to happen, but I think that people have the right incentive and they have the will and energy and power to use it. So I do feel like these sort of movements are crucial. So
do you think these times are affecting your work in the material that you're looking towards? Because for the people listening, a lot of your, or most of your work comes from your time in Mozambique growing up, and you really delve into the heritage of that country and the culture of that country in your work. And this current climate, do you feel like the work is changing at all?
No, actually. Like just to clarify, it's like, you know, the narratives or even the names of the character, or like when I think my approach to painting, it's very narrative based. So I think, you know, sort of like a person, a place, and a time. And so for me, my interest and curiosity lies between a rural Africa. And when I think about rural Africa, I'm thinking about sort of just the cadence of African life that I observed all over the continent. But then I might sort of start to cut it down a little bit, and I'll say, okay, well, it's a sort of more personal experience, so I will tend to relate it to Mozambique. You know, sometimes I'll just look at the map and I'll think about a name and I'll be like, okay, Chinde, you know, this is where my, say, grandmother's mother is from. And then I might sort of do some research on landscape. And if for me, it's really like, I don't know, it's kind of hard to describe. It's almost like these feelings that I've felt when I've traveled through rural Africa, it's sort of like it has been my most spiritual calm. And whenever I'm in times of kind of adversity, or I want to bring an ease to people, I think about those experiences. So like with Pippi's show in London, it was little is enough for those in love. So I took an East African proverb, and it was the thing about that show. I started that show in September last year, and I felt that I needed to share with people that at our truest living, our truest foundation, our truest happiness, it's family, community, and simplicity. And that's sort of what that show was about. It's like you had, you know, friends walking down the long path, and you had the, you know, sort of like lucid perspective of like, you know, these conjoined twins in the bottom corner of the painting with the woman getting married and the sort of like illustrious sky. It's almost like they're floating, and you know, so I wanted people to feel a sort of sense of relief from our burden of living a very capitalistic life, that you can retreat to this. And so for me, that felt like an intuitive process, because all of a sudden coronavirus breaks out, And then we're in this frenzy of buying, you know, and like we're so scared of losing, or and we're so scared of losing our job and not showing up to this, where it's like, actually, if you just kind of sit with yourself, you'll realize, you know, I have friends to me saying now, oh, I don't really need to go to restaurants anymore. I realize I don't need to, you know, go out to the fancy bars and this and that, you know. So I think it's like people are kind of getting back to a simpler way. I think also a lot of people who've had the privilege have been able to retreat to countryside, and they're seeing the beauty of living in countryside.
Yes.
And I do urge more people to try it out. If you can, try it out. Go live in the countryside. You will really find something wonderful if you just sit with yourself and do it. Because
looking at your Instagram, I mean, it is wonderful. It seems like you live a very organic life now. You live like with lovely greenery all around you, and it seems like you have. Do you have like you've
grown vegetables there? I just planted ferns.
There we
go. Herbs, vegetables. I just planted ferns outside my studio, and I'm working on cleaning the plot here. There's a plot that's not mine, and I'll still make a garden. I think that there's really something that's so, nice. Beautiful about leaving a soil in your fingernails. It's really healthy for your immunity.
When you eat dirt as a kid, I mean, I was always in the garden climbing trees, eating dirt out of the ground, and I think that
it's so good for you.
Yes, exactly, because you build up all the intolerances to everything. I think now everyone's got like allergies and everything because you don't have that experience of being out in nature eating acorns.
Exactly.
I've just planted my first herb garden for the first time in my life at the age of 39. So I've got all the herbs now I could ever need, and I've been cooking more. And that's all thanks
to
this time.
Medicine.
Your
medicine. You know, I realized I was cutting back some cat mint the other day, and I was like, oh, let me just look this up and make sure that I, you know, maybe I can use this in my kitchen. And I found out cat mint's really good for cramps and headaches. And I was like, wow, it like really, if you sort of get in touch with your
nature, has put it all there for us to
body,
find it. Yes.
It's there.
Yes.
You know, exactly. In the winter, I do these like long, long walks through the forest, and like, you know, I might eat some dew off the pine needles. And
dew.
No, dew.
Russell Tovey.
Yeah. I just might eat some poo the pine needles.
You
know,
you sound like you are a 5-year-old. I think you've reverted back to that time when you were eating soil outside in your garden.
No, but all this to say is that if you are living in the city and you're having second doubts of coming back to your apartment, you maybe don't need to. The city can't even hold as many people, really. New York City's disgusting. It's infested, you know? So now it's like almost like it's breathing a little bit. I was just in Brooklyn yesterday, you know? And then in terms, I want to go ahead and answer sort of the second question, which was, if Black Lives Matter, the what we're going through currently is sort of influencing my work, I mentioned the Pippi show just to say that when I make a show, the title comes to me. So
before the show,
when I was in LAMU, before the show, it's really weird. It's every show has been like that. Like with Francois Gabali was a day monkeys destined to die, all trees become slippery. And then I thought about this sort of like very kind of static movement within the work. Everything was quite stiff and it had this sort of like ominous feeling. So when I was in LAMU, I thought the title came to me, to live long is to see much. And I felt like maybe I need to make a show in South Africa where people have gone through a lot, a country, as a people, and they still continue to learn themselves and who they will be in kind of global players in the world. And I think Africa is always having that conversation. And I felt like I needed to give them something to kind of fight for. And so that's where I came up with To Live Long is to See Much. And so the way I work, you know, not to give too much away, because I do think this is something important being sacred, but I always do research around whatever I feel like the title kind of
brings to me spiritually. So this right. was sort of like looking at the term is infrequent, sort of like how black bodies within science, science sort of having its own racial injustices, you know, you know, and then these sort of like circus theater freak shows where they were displaying people actually not that freaky, you know, like for instance, like Sarah Bodman, who was the Venus quote unquote Hottentot.
Well, let's talk about this then. Talking about like, because you're talking about like the circus and everything, and you touched on it briefly earlier on about Siamese twins. There's lots of these characters yes. and motifs that appear through your work, and especially the Siamese twins that are quite this is again playing with the duality of two sides of everything in your work, is that they're quite from the off they look like a couple of young girls who are quite happy and they're well dressed and they look quite pleased with themselves, and then you realize that they're conjoined, so it has this like this dual hidden meanings and double meaning to them. What is that about the Siamese twins especially? But then there's like conjoined twins where there's three of them, and there's girls with four legs, and you know where is this in you found this, and why is that in your work and you're exploring that?
So this is sort of all leading up to my show with Goodman Gallery, where I felt that it's almost like, because my work deals with characters from African descent, that it's not enough to just like paint a black body and say that, you know, put a sort of European character and say, oh, you know, this is a black body being, you know, misused by a Caucasian, you know, like this is a painting portraying racism in a way. I wanted all bodies to look at this work as a sort of almost like questioning how you're caught off guard. This idea of queer, like what is queer? Is it because we've not been exposed to it? So for me, it's more along that research of like questioning why the things we see as different are inherently bad. So I'm kind of challenging that notion. So now we're living in this sort of day and age, for the most part, where people are open to learning. They're open to, you know, LGBTQ community. They're open to, you know, new ideas, especially even around what it is to be a painter. For a long time, it was a white man that was a painter, you know. Now it's like the people are wanting to be more open to who is calling themselves artists and including them in their own collections, including them in institutions, etc. So for me, the Siamese twins or the conjoined triplets or the four-legged woman is is more about kind of introducing or bringing back into the sphere of the conversation that we're having, is that we should just be open to everything. You know, like life will constantly be throwing you new terms, new ideas, new things will surface. Like we might find out there's another planet tomorrow. Like, and you know, so oh God, that's
not,
why
not,
the title.
Not this year. Not this year. Let's have this year off of this. Let's just have a bit of a break.
That's so interesting, Cassie, because so that obviously clearly links to this idea of the kind of freak show then, and those kind of 19th century European attractions. You know, you mentioned earlier this idea of the Hottentot Venus. And Sarah Bartman. So can you talk a bit about that? Yeah. Is that going to be featuring that kind of theme within the Goodman Gallery show then?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, I wanted to touch base or sort of bring to light imperialism in Africa. I've been thinking a lot about, like, you know, I had just found out, and I have to try and do more research, but within my research, you know, I've been thinking a lot about slavery, and I've been doing the research in Mozambique, and I find out where my mother's from in Kiliman, that there was a slave, Vasco da Gama from Portugal, came there. He named it the River of Good Signs, you know. But I had found out that there was a sort of mass exodus of slave boats leaving from my mother's region. Mm-hmm. And I learned that the Prazo system was also taking place there. So
what's that?
From how I understand the Prazo system or how it was handled in Kilimani, sort of gives me a lot of insight into why Kilimani is what it is today, where it was, you know, Portuguese Europeans marrying into or, you know, taking over different tribes or regions within Zambezia. And they were, within the marrying of the system, they were acquiring land. And they would go on to build plantations, crops, and like, so. And then there was also the term that was coined, which is mulatto, you know, a mixed person. So that's sort of this intent of like creating a race. So, you know, every, like, the French did it different from the Portuguese and the English did it different from the French and from the Portuguese. So it, and then you also have the Arabs that went into Zanzibar, Lamu, all along the Swahili coast, who also had a different technique, but a little, kind of much more similar to the Portuguese, of sort of marrying into communities. And that's where you had the Swahili people that were created. And in Mozambique and Angola, it was the mulatto, and in Cabo Verde, it was the Creole. So it's sort of this, like, I'm thinking a lot also about the agency, you know, of taking back what's sort of belonging to you. And so I'm playing with sort of both the notions. It's like this idea of the body being a physical asset to another member that has no idea, no understanding of your beauty, one, you know, your society. They just see you as a quote unquote savage. So I'm really interested in how these, you know, these particular figures were sort of lost in culture. You know, like the twins that I paint are the McCoy twins. They're from, I believe, North Carolina or South Carolina. They were born into slavery, and then they traveled all around the world in this sort of circus freak show, and they were treated very poorly. They were subject to horrible scientific kind of experiments and research, and their bodies never belonged to them. And I feel that we're not that far away from that today. You know, it's sort of like...
What year was that? So that was in Victorian times, was it? That was...
Wasn't it like late 1800s?
It was late 1800s.
Wow,
yeah.
So they were conjoined twins born into slavery, and they were taken from... the parents,
yes,
and then just
toured
just around,
bought
and
sold and bought, yeah. But they were, you know, always in beautiful dressings, obviously, because they would be like in these like kind of Moulin Rouge type of places, like very wealthy kind of bars and people, and they were beautiful, you know. And but later on in their life, they settled back in the South, and they did a lot for Black American people, for African American people. They put money where communities needed, you know, within ultimately their work was a type of slavery. They had no freedom. And even with that, they put currency back into the community. And I was like, wow, these are twins that need to be known. And so it's almost like I felt sad, because I was like, I didn't know about them, and the fact that because they're conjoined, they were written off. And I felt like it's almost like a haunting that I have. It's like I needed to bring them back into surface, into some sort of gesture that people can now revisit them. Of course, it's a painting and it's different, but I believe in spirit, you know. And I believe in the sort of like, if you manifest, and I can give them some sort of homage, and And I also thought a lot about like wet nurses, and that were sort of, you know, in Brazil, like it was a huge slave trade, the wet nurses. And so, and one of them that I was looking at was Negus of Ethiopia, his wet nurse, where her name was Nuris. And you only find her in postcards. And she has this very beautiful kind of distinct face, and then these like breasts that fall to her knees. And obviously she was a sort of object of infrequent. So people would take these like, photos of her because of her breast, from all her nursing of, the society, the high society's children. And I felt maybe that this would be crucial and sort of an inherent feeling for me to put these characters on, or explore them right now, and they might end up in The Good Men, but I and to create some sort of narrative conscious around or being open to this sort of unknowing, or this sort of mysterious figures that we haven't been exposed to, so.
Yeah. Wow. There is a figure that because we're talking about your narratives, and you're definitely a storyteller with your work, but there are characters that appear, and there is a character of Maria which features throughout your work and feels like someone that you can project a lot of metaphors onto. Where did she come from?
She came from... So Maria is sort of a metaphor. Maria is a metaphor for oppressed people, she shows up in this sort of very beautiful woman, sort of more than dualistic. She's sort of very fluid between different emotions. And I created her because when I made one of my first shows, Bar Texas 1971. Like, it was like the sort of like show based around like one night in this bar and sort of all the different kind of anxieties and chaos that imperialism, colonialism left behind in a sort of country that's trying to figure themselves out. So,
this is Mozambique.
Mozambique, correct. Yeah. And then, like my paintings stem from a lot of things. It stems from reading, it stems from cinema, it stems from photography. And, Maria was this character that I had seen different photos of these night-walking women in downtown Maputo. And it was just by the photographer Ricardo Rangel. And he had like these amazing sort of like Vogue-esque images of these like nightwalkers and or streetwalkers.
What's his name?
And they're sort of like, they're like Ricardo Rangel.
Ricardo Rangel. I've not heard. Have you heard of him, Rob?
No, I haven't. No.
And he's not known. People know Malik Sidibe. But I think he wasn't a studio photographer. He did documenting a very specific time within Mozambique, at that time Lorenzo Marx in Maputo City, and he made a series called Our Nightly Bread, and that was all these wonderful, intense and beautiful and vulnerable images of life at that time. And for me, I think it's one of the most beautiful bodies of work. And it really struck me. And my mom had developed photographs for Tempo Archive, which he leaves behind. It's sort of his legacy. It's sort of a school where one can go and learn, film photography, use a dark room. And, it's such an important space. So when I made Bar Texas 1971, I actually, my gallery, the Library Street Collective people at that time, we said, well, why not contact, you know, Tempo and see if, or see, sorry, not Tempo, CCFM, the Central for Photography Institute or something like this, which is also attached to Tempo magazine. And let's see if we can get them to send us over some images where we can sort of do a large wallpaper.
Well, that's sort of the gist of Maria. She's sort of like this metaphor of a kind of oppressed people. And I like that with her, I can sort of travel to many different places and sort of thinking and put her in these sort of, you know, vulnerable scenarios, but also scenarios that kind of challenge the viewer in a way. Or kind of make you think, like, there's, you know, Maria's free spirit is inspired by an Emil Nold free spirit.
Yeah.
And I thought about how, you know, when the night walking ladies, when they, you know, you weren't really, that was sort of illegal. It was definitely illegal because the government at the time, going through this independent struggle, they wanted women to be also on, not necessarily on the front lines, but that was totally an option too, but to be kind of team players on how to throw the opposition, you know, and have a free Mozambique. So they wanted women to kind of place these like sort of secret agricultural farms that the freedom fighters can go and have food and rest and this sort of thing. So the Marias were sort of like these kind of, in a way, kind of like living on their own terms and sort of radical in a way. And I kind of felt that sort of woman or that sort of thinking sometimes is to be admired. Or respected, at least.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at UH1.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser's also given people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and talk art with Sir Peter Blake.
And also, yeah, the painting you're discussing, Maria Free Spirit, which is actually 2020, so it's this year, was one of the works that really stuck out to me when we were researching the episode. And I felt an incredible strength from her. And this, I felt a kind of love for her because, you know, she's wearing this amazing kind of yellow jacket, but she also just looks so kind of loving herself. And even though you've got this situation which could be kind of risky or dangerous, or, you know, because there's a car in the background, it's quite an ominous feeling. At the same time, you've got this really powerful woman, and you kind of feel her strength. And I don't know, I really connected with her. And that's funny that you ended up bringing that up, because that was something I was going to discuss, because I wanted to know about her as well, like Russell did. So,
oh, yeah, it's really, well, you know, she's actually... I just had a studio visit yesterday, and so she's right in front of me. But so I'm able to really look at her. But yeah, there's like so much going on in this painting, and this, you know, she is in the foreground. She's quite a strong force, and everything outside of her is almost just a mirage.
Totally.
You know, it's almost like to say this is what I've been through up until now, or sort of like, this is what I'm up against. And then there's sort of like this, when you think about aura or a kind of like guiding light.
Yeah, because I sort of saw a halo. It was almost like a religious icon or something, yeah.
Mm-mm-mm.
And then she has this like beautiful pink sort of floating floor or something. It's almost like she's walking on, you know, people might say like the ground you walk on or something is blessed or this sort of thing. So I feel this painting is hugely about symbolism, you know,
and sort of looking
to ourselves for that sort of strength, something we can learn or respect about her.
I love that idea of the past and the future, and like how it could actually just be like memories of her experiences, and now she's at this place where she's free in herself and in control. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, she's amazing. But there was something that I said to Russell when he first introduced the work to me. I felt this real parallel to an artist that I first discovered in the Lebanon. I saw an exhibition by Etel Adnan, who's a artist who I think is in her 70s or 80s now, and she makes paintings often of landscapes. And there was something about the way that you paint that made me feel very free when I was looking at the nature. And there was almost like, mm-hmm. like you were talking about earlier, this kind of like, you know, goodbye to capitalism, kind of the way people are going to mm-hmm. reevaluate the way they're living now, and a return to mm-hmm. nature. But I felt like a kind mm-hmm. of calling to nature just by looking at your paintings, which mm-hmm. I also experienced mm-hmm. with Etel's work. So is mm-hmm. there something in that way that you make landscape paintings, a bit like when you're talking about that kind of sacred floor that Maria is walking mm-hmm. on, mm-hmm. there's a kind of mm-hmm. simplicity and purity in the way that you apply the paint. And how has that style kind of been developed? Is it something deliberate, or is it just instinctive for you?
It's totally instinctive. I'm very free when I'm mm-hmm. making work. And I think that my calling to paint is an ancestral calling. And I think the way that someone might be connected to the landscape in the painting, or someone like the Lebanese artist you had mentioned, mm-hmm. it's because if you're living in your ancestral body, if you're connected to your kind of ancestral past, there is some yearning for rural land. Yeah. There is some yearning for something outside of our living that has become our mundane. And I feel that this is important to share and to express to people the sort of multitude of feelings that one can have when you're living in that sort of, I don't know, somatic experience of, like, you know, walking up a cliff or walking through a red, dirty path. And, you know, dirty meaning, like, beautiful. It's like dusty. It's like, you know, dusty,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's almost like maybe we don't know we're longing for it, but it's there. And maybe you find that out when you're looking at a painting with a landscape, or I hope that maybe one might feel that when they're looking at my work.
I think it's also due to the richness of color, because it's so mm-hmm. evocative, your color choices, mm-hmm. and there is something mm-hmm. that it just calls to senses, you know, to one senses, like.
It's a mood. It feels like there's a mood. I feel relaxed when I look mm-hmm. at your paintings, but then I also then I look at the themes, or I look at the characters sometimes, and I can feel a sort of traumatic past in mm-hmm. there. So mm-hmm. you have this juxtaposition of emotions when you look at your work. And there is a simplicity, as Rob was saying, to your characters that almost to me feel folk arty. Is that intentional? Mm-hmm. Is that something that you've looked towards? And what are your kind of art heroes that you look at for your own work?
Well, I'd like to think that I sort of have this like deep well in my own self, and that maybe I can pull deeper and deeper and deeper from inside that well, and the things that would come out are true and honest, and that would be me making my life's work in some ways, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. I do feel that is the most individualistic thing that one can do. And I think that that true individualism becomes universalism in a way. It's like we can all approach and respect that concept and that notion. If everyone were to do that inner work in whatever they're doing in their life, then we would have very rich things to share with one another. And so all this to say is that I'm constantly exploring, and that when I am in that moment, I hope to God it's honest and true, and that I'm doing it from my well. And if that were to ever be challenged, then I have an issue. And in terms of artists that I look to. I'm deeply, deeply inspired by painting and painters. So I don't really look at kind of contemporary artists. I feel that there is something from my spirit and my thinking from another time. And mm-hmm. I think that there's very much something that I can learn from looking at masters. And I think about Cézanne. I think about, you know, Van Gogh. I think about, there's something I love about Chagall's work. I think that there's something mm-hmm. pure and honest and magical, and, you know, him being of Jewish descent and what the Jewish diaspora had to go through. I think there's mm-hmm. something really amazing. I love the kind of visceralness of what's the artist's name that I love so much? Egon Schiele. So I like raw. I like purity. I can see when something is instinctive and true. And I felt that even when I look at, I know I've just named European painters, but I can see that also when I look at a Beaufort Delaney painting or a Bob mm-hmm. Thompson yep. sort of, mm-hmm. you know, yep. Favre style painting. Like, I feel that there's something that, it's like listening to music that strikes a chord in you or something, you know, you feel it. And I think that that combined with the deep inner work, you will have something to go with for a very long time. So,
yeah, indeed. Yes.
I've read that you like German Expressionism, especially the artists that look towards Africa or like indigenous cultures for their innovations that mm-hmm. were also an influence on your work. Because there's a lot of indigenous culture themes. There's Makonde carvings, which mm-hmm. I actually came to through your work, through a little painting mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. we were talking mm-hmm. about, that these carved wooden indigenous craft, these indigenous artifacts have really inspired many, many artists, but they're also featuring in your work.
Yeah. You know, when I made this, one of my first shows was a work on paper called Meat is Meat. And it was at Oof Books in LA, a small, like, wonderful little bookshop. And some of the paintings there had people, Mapiko dance masks that I painted mm-hmm. in these sort of different scenarios. And I only later realized that I was like, well, you know, so many European painters were drawing masks, painting masks, you know, Picasso was deeply inspired by it. And it's almost like, in a way, Africa was looted of its sort of cultural objects. It's, mm-hmm. you know, and it wasn't seen as an art practice or anything for that sort of currency. They were divinations. They were, you know, sort of tribal belongings that kind of one would go to for whatever offerings or prayer. They were deep members of societies or deep objects of society. And then to see it taken and reappropriated in a for the sake of art, it does something to me. But then there's also this curiosity of how we sort of pick what we feel most, I don't know, curious or sensitive of. So I felt like Picasso's sort of connection with these masks, he was very inspired by the naivety or the simplicity, you know. Mm-hmm. And his work is very loose. So I was really interested in how this man, this painter, this artist was inspired by these masks, you know. And for me, it felt like the Makonde so deeply, deeply inspired by it. This group of artists, these sculptures, I felt a true calling or curiosity to learn from them mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. And take it and put it into narratives, because all those sculptures have narrative. You know, they're all folkloric. They're all looking at sort of folklore or myths that sort of define the culture and how people move around Swahili life, Makonde life. And it feels like this sort of like idea that life in these rural settings are sort of based on these folklores. I felt like this, we also in the West have these kind of folkloric ideas of what we understand. I don't think a folklore is bad, but I think it's like this idea of like challenging. And in the work that we see at Nina Johnson's, it's this sort of like kind of serpent, you know, figures. So the sex is fluid of the figures, and there's sort of this kind of
almost like isn't it?
Like exorcism and this sort of like force, and it's a very sort of gray area in what whether and going back to sort of like the duality, but then meeting in the middle where it's okay to not know. And I think the Makonde kind of play around with that a lot. It's like one of the sculptures I was really interested in was like this like woman with these sort of long ears, and they said she's like a shatani. Shatani means devil, devil's whore,
witchcraft.
Like lost in a kind of agriculture of cassava. Like she lives in the cassava leaves, and so I think about that in the sort of metaphor of society here and maybe translating that into a painting. So it's all this sort of dovetail of narrative that ends up with paint.
Yeah. Can we touch on something now, which is you have actually made history because while we've been in lockdown, you were actually asked to paint the cover of Vogue Italia, which is made during photoless times. So it's the first time the covers have featured works that weren't using models. What was that? What was that experience like? And you were what was your brief for that? And how did that come about? And how brilliant that is! That cover looks so cool.
Oh, thank you. Well, actually, that Vogue Italia cover, I think, might have released a little bit before 2020, but I definitely started that.
Oh, okay.
I think might have been like December, January, or something like this. But it was a very interesting experience. I would say like there's something that I love the notion and I love the concept and the idea and. Commissions are always a funny thing for me in a way. I mean, just someone saying like approaching me to make a painting and there's this sort of guiding. But I ended up shortly after sort of a couple of moments of being unclear because it's tough making a magazine cover. You don't know what people want, you know? Yeah. And I realized it's not about that. It's just like, it's just about making what looks good and what feels true to me. So yes, I went with sort of my spiritual palette, which was that soft green. And, you know, they had sent a model over to my studio. And then I was concerned about likeness. And then I painted a model. Yeah.
Right.
And so that's the thing. It's like a lot of the other artists didn't paint a model. They just sent a photo or whatever. But, you know, there was a model sent to my studio. And I don't know if she was super comfortable being painted. She seemed quite nervous. It's hard. It's one thing to be a model. It's another thing to be a sitter for a painter.
Yes. Two that's a long. Things. How long did it take?
I'm immediate. I love painting people. I don't do it very often, but I really, really enjoy it. And I love to do it for time. So,
Right. You really pressured her to sit there for as long as you needed. Yeah.
Well, it was more like trying to do it as fast as possible and do a couple. Uh-huh. But the thing is, I need my sitter to really, really be still. And otherwise, I can't get the angles right of the face if she's moving around. And it still comes up, but it's not likeness. And sometimes I guess I realize like a painting is not about whether the person looks like it. It's what the painting looks like. So after she left, I was just like, okay, I'm just going to do it like my way, you know?
Yeah.
And I painted her essence. It's almost like the essence she left behind.
Wow. And like the trace or something.
Yeah. It was weird. It was like I was thinking about like her shape, you know, less about the face. I think sometimes modeling, you know, and it can sometimes leave a very... It's like you know how to be in front of the character, the camera, you show your best self.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think that may be translated into our moment. But when she left, I was able to think about spirit. See, it's when you're a sitter, when you're someone that hasn't modeled, you can sit in front of a painter and I can see all the vulnerability. Yeah. I can see every kind of humanness about you. And
do you think you're quite a spiritual person, Cassie?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I do feel like I'm a spiritual person. I think I hold a lot of, I don't know, inner workings that I feel are kind of like transcended from something bigger in a way. I think a lot about sort of, I don't know, something, I think that the divine, you know, and like my work really it explores concepts of godliness. And right now I'm
magic.
Reading...
It feels like it's a magic theme, like magic runs through your work.
Yeah, it's sort of like we don't have to have everything be a sort of scientific explanation in living. Like, you know, it's like I like to think when a rainbow shows up, it's just good omen. I like to think after a dry summer, rain means abundance, rather than thinking about what the clouds and the sky and the cumulus thing and the humidity and the, you know, so I just feel like there's something more to live for when you believe in sort of the magic or the simplicity
of it, rather than really, you're saying the scientific workings, you as you're saying right at the beginning of this conversation about getting back to simpler times, getting back to nature, really just looking at the world from that angle where it's more awe-inspiring, it's much more exciting to navigate through.
Of course you might find that you might take up writing or take up music or another language, or you might be meditating. It really makes you a more fuller person. And I was walking with my friend in the city yesterday. I was in Brooklyn. And I said, you know, I said, it's weird. It's almost like the city needed to rupture and it needed to shut down for people to realize that time doesn't have to be a currency. And, you know, because from what I heard from my friend Haley, she was just like, you know, when the COVID happened, people were sort of like stepping outside of their house, like, and it was like this really intense, like almost zombie lost, what's the purpose of living in life kind of notion that was like sort of ingrained on people's faces. And then it's like, as that sort of passes, like everything passes in life, you know, we have to remember that. And then this sort of like solidarity movement begins and this sort of like wanting more and wanting better for just our lives. Became sort of like the bar. It wasn't about, you know, where am I going to go Friday night with such and such and who's going and this sort of thing, you know? And it was wonderful. It's like, I think in New York City now for the next 2 years, you can drink open alcoholic beverage on the streets.
Oh yeah, that's a new thing that's come out.
It's well,
that's
super a great new
thing to come out of COVID.
So I walked around last night with a Corona beer on my hand, and it was
well, that's history. Yes,
10 at night, and I was like, "There's something really special about this city," you know. But it's just like, and you saw people dancing, and you know, protesters giving out water to one another. It was really wonderful. I mean, I think that we're in this like cultural, spiritual shift. And yeah, that's why I kept calling the lockdown, you should consider it a spiritual vacation. Because like we really are in this like shift. And I think that it's needed.
You know what's so interesting as well is that going back to the Vogue Italia cover, because that was to do with sustainability. And there's been all these discussions for at least a decade now within the fashion world, which has been kind of cynically adopted, in my opinion, with some of the bigger fashion brands where they kind of try to make out they're being more sustainable and caring about environment. But I think, you know, by the beginning of 2020, it had got to the point where, you know, you've got the world's greatest fashion magazine actually doing a whole issue dedicated to sustainability. You know, which is such an interesting thing to have come just before COVID. And if you think of the Me Too movement, which was also, you know, shattering in society and made so many people wake up to different abuses towards women and it was also started by a person of color, by a black woman, that whole movement. And also the ecological awareness that of the youth, you know, the younger generations waking up with Greta Thunberg and all of these kind of massive events that have happened in the past few years leading up to now. That's kind of why I believe change can happen now, because I actually think the younger generation are becoming more politically aware, which is kind of why I spoke about being political in the beginning, you know, and freedom, this right. idea of freedom and personal freedoms, you know, that idea that you can now walk down the street holding a beer in your hand.
yeah. It's like we have to ask ourselves as a society in what way and what will we do to choose how we'd like our futures to be for our children and for our neighbors and for our own sake of sanity. And I think that those are questions, maybe sometimes it's not always easy to answer, but life brings you, you know, things you don't always expect. And there's, you know, you can choose to look the other way or you can choose to really deal with it. And I think that that even goes with a self-working approach with one's own life, you know. So I think it's really like I do believe in a sort of I believe in a sort of universal happiness, you know, and I think it can happen. To get there, it's not easy, but I think that we are doing the work, and it feels that this is going down I believe a sort of healthier future, you know. I really I do feel that way. I think people are more sensitive now than ever. They think about what they eat, you know, and they want kind of food security for everyone, you know. And so it's almost like we're thinking about with the world changing so fast and everything that's sort of at our fingertips, like good and bad, it's almost like if we don't quality control right now, it's going to blow up, you know?
Well, here. I think we need to prioritize empathy and compassion and understanding for, you know, others and, make that our priority and commit to that, make that commitment going forward.
Yeah, totally, you know? We're all in this sort of journey together, journey called life, you know? So.
Totally.
Yeah.
So Cassie, we ask every guest that comes on two questions. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, if you could have any work of artwork in the world, whatever it is, a building, a drawing, a sculpture, anything, what would it be and why?
Well, that's a tough one.
Especially considering we've been talking about kind of owning things like capitalist society.
Yeah, it's like, yes, yeah.
Now if tell us what you would take for yourself. Yeah, exactly.
You know what? I mean, it's like I kind of live that way anyway. I feel like I'm super attracted to like really old, like special African art.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. There's like so many good ones. It's like I'd love like an Akan headpiece, you know, from
What's
the Ghana
like?
Tribe.
All right.
I'm wanting to open up my book, but I don't want to walk away from you right now. But yeah, it's like they were just master like goldsmiths, you know, and I feel like those to live with something from the Akan tribe would be incredible, and that for me is sort of like an art piece in itself. I'm like really fascinated and interested in like objects that were sort of, you know, in these sort of high realms of sort of sex in the cultural societies.
So the other question we ask every guest is, what is your favorite color?
Lavender.
Oh, really?
Ooh, are you growing lavender? Is that why?
I love lavender. I mean, I have like cat mint that's lavender, and I have like, I'm growing alliums, so the kind of onion bulbs, and those are sort of like a deep lavender. And I paint with a lot of lavender, but more like a lilac. And that shows up in my work a lot because I feel like it has calming qualities. So one of my friends once called me a colorist sage. And I really do believe that one can heal through color. Like, you know, I wear a lot of like mustard and yellow because I just feel like it makes people happy. It's a good energy.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
I actually find the plant lavender, like, it's my favorite plant. And I planted a lot in my garden here in Margate. And I remember my mum saying to me, but why are you planting so much lavender? But, like, it brings me so much joy because of all the senses,
yes.
Because it smells so great. Mm-hmm. It looks so great when it flowers.
It's
and
amazing.
Mine have just flowered, and it is the most exciting week of my life.
Oh,
literally.
Lucky you. Yeah,
it's
I'm
just
growing
rewarding.
Lavender.
Yeah. But it's amazing when you do grow plants and they actually do grow and you don't kill them.
So incredible.
You feel like you've really achieved something.
Seriously, my whole garden.
Years,
Cassie, I'm
like,
going to send you photos.
Oh, yeah, send me photos. Yeah, and I drink lavender tea every night. So
do you?
It's so good for you. It's so good.
I need to try. I haven't done that.
It's wonderful. And like elderberry tea has been a big one for me too because of the this kind of allergy season. It's supposed to clear the sinuses, you know.
Awesome.
Another purplish.
You're magic. You're magic.
Thank
so
you.
You're right now. You are aiming towards your show at Goodman Gallery in South Africa towards the end of the year. Do you have a date for that yet, or we're all still in limbo?
We love Goodman Gallery.
It's November. It's set for November.
22nd.
Yes.
And that's what you're working towards now.
Yes, I'm working towards it, and the beginning is always like a crazy thing for me because it's like there's so much energy and there's so much kind of anxious energy to kind of want to sort of get the show sort of in this.
Perfect.
It's almost like working in like cinema, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like I want to make sure that the story is cohesive and it's tight and it feels like I can give something to someone that they can walk away with. So it's different when I'm making a single painting versus like a show that's what I'm working on right now, and I'm currently doing some research in the studio today, so yeah, that's really exciting.
And actually I had a Zoom call the other day with Joe Stelar-Savica from Goodman Gallery and Justin as well, Justin Davey, because we were chatting about possibly making a print with you one day.
Oh my God, I would love that.
Yeah, which could be a very exciting thing for the future for Counter Editions. So yeah, watch this space, hopefully.
That sounds great.
It would be a major privilege to collaborate with you.
Yeah.
So that's very exciting.
Yes.
Maybe a print from the 2020 Goodman show. I feel like why not? That would be great.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It would be amazing.
Do you know how many works you're making for that?
Yeah, I have 12 canvases sitting in my studio. And the show will have, you know, one larger work, a 66 and a half by 92 inches, and then a very small painting, like 18 by 18 inches. So,
Do you have a favorite scale you work on?
You know, I have the scales that I go to. A lot, this show, I think, has more horizontal paintings than vertical.
Right.
And the space is quite unique in Johannesburg. It's the kind of heritage building, a lot of kind of circular architecture to the space. So I had to really consider scale. And I was very lucky because finally my art supply store in Soho opened up. I really love working on cotton poly. It's a sort of like a more firm canvas, and I use the aluminium stretcher bars on the back. So that's what's it'll be super durable to get to South Africa from New York, and I have the scales all set up. I kind of mocked it up on the interweb. Well, not me. My boyfriend's really good at doing that stuff. So I'll just give him the sizes, and he'll mock up the space. Yeah, I always mock up the space, and I always I really consider size. So that's like a big important factor when it comes to like working the paintings into the individual sizes. So
And when you work on all 12 of, you said you got 12 canvases now, will you work on all of them at once or one at a time?
You know, this time it'll be unique because my space is quite big. It's 1,800 square foot, but I'm set to leave in July for a month. And I will make small paintings wherever I am. I think I might go to the Azores or somewhere. I'm not sure. Or I might take a road trip to New Hampshire.
Lovely.
And I just kind of want the change of pace. I tend to always make one or two works in a show where I travel. But always there's a consistent palette. I think a lot about palette as well. And then I tend to sort of, because the palette is consistent, it usually means that I'm working on all of them sort of around the same time, or if not two by two, then I might group them together. So this, you see that kind of in Pippi's show in London, there's sort of like groupings of paintings that kind of speak to each other and sort of this like color language. So,
do you find it hard to let your paintings go to be sold? And what is the dream for you? Where would you want your work to be shown? What is there a dream institution or collection you'd like to be in?
You know, it's not, there's some work that is hard for me. This is actually, right now I have a lot of my work in my studio, and this is because of the COVID, things haven't been able to ship out so quickly. And it's been sort of weird having my paintings sit with me for this long, because I'll like sort of like look at the corner of that painting and I want to like touch it up a little bit and like work, you know? So it's like this sort of like, I do have a painting rack, of course, painting storage where I can put the paintings away, but it's almost like they've become my sort of studio mates in a weird way, like the Siamese twins and the thing. But no, there's sort of this, like whenever they leave me, it's sort of like your children go off to college and it's like you're like can be left alone for a while. It kind of feels like that. It's like I'm excited that they're kind of taking on this new life. Oh. And it's like my intention was there. And now there's like something new I want to birth. So it's like there's like this like constant cycle, like this like sort of seasonal like movement or something. As far as institutions, I really like the Dia Museum in Detroit. Yeah. I think they have a wonderful collection, and you know, also folk art, and you know, and then I also really I quite like the Baltimore Museum. You know, I'm thinking more sort of like in internally, and of course, like the Tate would be wonderful. I love the Tate so much.
Yes,
we do too, and we would love to have you in London. That'd be so
there's
exciting.
There's a lot of. And yeah, I think there needs to be, you know, I had the most wonderful opening in London. I love London so much. Mm. It's like when I go there, I just feel so So I don't know. It's like this ease or something. I just really enjoy the sensibility it lended. It's so fun.
Oh, well, we want you back.
It was a nice turnout.
Well, before we go, I just want to talk about titles, because we talked about the shows you're talking, and that show you were just talking about was Little Is Enough for Those in Love at Pibby Holdsworth, and then we've talked about your show in Miami, which is called Dog Meat, Cat Meat, God Knows What Meat, and then there's titles of your pieces, but the one that I really love is Four-Legged Girl Awaits Her Beloved in Melancholy, Letters Are Exchanged, Loneliness Has Replaced Pining 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Which for me, I just think is like so poetic and kind of so random in what it's brought together. But I think it's so beautiful. And
thank
I think
you.
Like how important titles are for you. They seem to be the because it's carrying on the storytelling and the narrative, right?
Yeah, well, you know, like I feel it's funny that you mentioned that painting. But no, you know, my earlier work had like sometimes I think of my title sometimes in proses, and my earlier work was like these very long titles, and I think that there's something about I mentioned to someone who had a studio visit with me the other day, it's like, how do you create, like, you know, sort of techniques or find out new sort of enjoyments in your work? And it's really when I'm left alone, it's like there's no distractions and there's like this sort of quiet time with my thoughts. And I think sort of deep down inside, there's always been this sort of yearning to keep writing as a practice.
Yes.
I feel like poetry is sort of a lost art, and it's something that I think that everyone should attempt to do for themselves. And you might surprise yourself. I sometimes teach to my friend's daughter. This is a thing that I've taken up on Zoom. I'll teach some of my friend's kids. And my friend Josie and her daughter, the one of the homeworks I gave them was to write a poem about Mother Earth. And as funny as it may seem, it was like it was so easy. Because I think when you take up a practice that is, you know, anything spiritual, which is music or painting or dancing or something, it often brings you back to a kind of a language, a connection with the earth. And it was just like the most beautiful poetry. And I didn't do my homework. I didn't write it in advance. And I showed up with them on, in class on Zoom. And they said, won't you write something? And I wrote something so free within about 3 minutes. And that sort of surprised me. It's sort of that intuition or that intuitiveness when you are honest to the moment. And I think when I made that painting, I thought about everyone who was starting love during COVID. And then had to cease from their partners or their admirers, God, yeah, or whoever, you know what I mean? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, and sometimes letters are exchanged, but it can, the flame can also die out. Time is a very funny way of making things sort of more obsolete in a way. You know?
Yeah, definitely. I actually met a guy in Margate who's a friend on the beach, and he was with someone, you know, when we were social distance walking at one point, and I didn't recognize the person he was with, and it was actually like a new boyfriend that he'd met, and they decided to like live together during the lockdown, even though they'd only just met like a month before or something. And
that's what I'm saying.
It was hilarious.
There's so many, yeah. You had people who...
And they were doing good.
Well, no, he said they were doing good.
You had people who were willing to take risks.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And he said they actually were having separate bedrooms
funny.
So that it wasn't too intense. So like, yeah. so they would actually have alone time and privacy as well as spending,
yeah,
you know, dates and stuff. And I thought that was really clever. But I also thought it was very sweet because in those early throes of love, it's like, it's quite a nice thing to have that intense connection anyway, I guess. But it's a bit braver than me.
Period.
I don't think I would have been that brave.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Cassie.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure speaking with both of you.
Yeah, it's been the dream. And I really hope we get to hang out in real life very soon. And thank you so much to Nina Johnson.
Yeah, we'll see what's to come.
And to Goodman Gallery and to Joe Stelasavica and everybody who helped organize this wonderful chat today.
Yeah, and all images we talked about will be appearing on our Instagram feed at TalkArt. And you're on Instagram. You have two pages on Instagram, don't you? One that's predominantly all your work and one is your vegetables and herbs.
Yes, exactly. one more of my Cassie, like, ponderings and whatever.
Nature. Cassie and nature, yes.
Exactly.
That's at Cassie Namoda, your name. And then the other one is, what is the one that's predominantly your work?
Cass_Amanda, and it's like double A at the end. So
we will link to both of those on our Instagram so people can find it easily. And
thank you so much
very soon. Thanks for listening.
Cheers, Cassie.
Okay,
thanks,
cheers,
everyone.
See you soon, Cassie. Have a very wonderful evening. Bye-bye.
You too. Lots of love.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.